I'd like to ask you to please help me welcome Noreen A. from Modesto as our speaker tonight.
Hi, I'm Noreen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'm fascinated by the chip suitcases. All right, let me get this started here. Start. All right. So, newcomers, I just want to say, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Put on your seatbelt. Hope you got an airbag. Because recovery is a hell of a ride. Anyway, my sobriety date is August 23rd, 1989. Which means I'm 33 and some change, one day at a time. And I'm a second generation recovering alcoholic. My dad got sober in April of 1959. And he just passed away in December with 63 years of sobriety. So I'm trying to follow in his footsteps. Big feet, gonna be a problem. Anyway, I grew up in a recovering household. I have an older brother and a younger sister. Neither of them are afflicted as I have been. I was the chosen one. Not a bad thing. I always felt different. I don't know, maybe you felt that way too? I felt like I didn't quite fit in. Always felt different. And I was also, by the way, not a daily drinker. Nope. Not one of those. Just like my dad, I was a occasional, or I'd say, like to say, periodic alcoholic. And I just want to let you know that if you drink over a long period of time, those periods will get longer and shorter between, just so you know. It doesn't matter. Anyway, just really quickly, I need a little help from you guys. First of all, I never got a DUI, so anybody who got a DUI, could you raise your hand? Wow, thanks for taking my turn. And anybody who went to jail over behind drinking, would you... Wow, thanks for taking my turn again. I didn't do that. We won't ask anybody who went to the place where they wear paper slippers. All right. I didn't do that either. And I don't know why none of those happened for me. It wasn't my journey. Although I certainly drove drunk often. I certainly did things that would qualify for arrest and incarceration. And I certainly was crazy enough that that puzzled me why they didn't just lock me up somewhere. But that wasn't my journey. One of the things that did happen for me, though, even though growing up in a recovering household, with AA always being around, I can remember early on my dad going to these meetings, and there weren't that many meetings in Modesto, so there were meetings in a town nearby called Turlock and one in Stockton, and a bunch of them would get together in cars, and off they'd go to these meetings. And my mom was a black belt Al-Anon. When he'd start getting cranky, she'd go, "Don't you think you need to go to a meeting?" And we would notice it too. So, that restless, irritable discontent, I grew up around it, and I also acquired it myself. So, and I always knew something wasn't quite right. Something wasn't quite right. But I didn't want it to be that I was an alcoholic because, drinking kind of felt kind of good because it shut things off. Shut off those feelings. Shut off those feelings of being less than. Feelings of being, not quite good enough. Having so much ego and yet no self-esteem. All those things. Feeling like you were a bad person. Feeling that no matter what you did, it wouldn't be good enough. Feeling that no matter what you said, you weren't smart enough. And that's what I grew up feeling. And I grew up around the same thing as my brother and sister, and they didn't feel that way. It was me. That's part of my disease. One of the things that didn't happen to me because of drinking, I didn't drink until I was, the late age of 16 and a half. I felt really old by then. We drank, I grew up, again, Modesto, home of Gallo wine. You could buy a big-ass bottle, a very large container of alcohol at Red Mountain, Pink Chablis, $1.56.
Red Mountain.
Red Mountain. I don't know what it costs today. I'm sure it's a bit more, because that was a while ago. That was a few years back, but I don't even look. And I will tell you that my friends, you know, you got to drink, yeah, I got to drink. And I was like, no, no, no. And I knew it shouldn't drink. You know, people, good girls don't drink. And, you know, oh, you know, maybe not. And it didn't smell all that wonderful. But eventually, you know, I took a swig and then something happened. It was like this switch. It was like, whoa, that felt pretty good. And next thing I know, I'm chugging the wine. And that's the way my drinking was. Always trying to hide it too, because, you know, I couldn't, God forbid, I, you know, drink and have my dad find out, or those AA people, you know, would come get me. They were always around. We grew up, the first time I went to an AA meeting was in 1959. And I was like 7 and a half years old. Just so you don't have to do the math, I'm 71 now. It was a big room, and there was all these different people, kind of like now. It's like, it's a variety here. Everybody was smiling and laughing, and there was food, and that is always an attraction for me. I am down with the potluck. I remember looking at these people and thinking, wow, I want to grow up and be just like them. Ta-da! So I remember one particular lady giving me this look, kind of looking at me, and there was something about the way she looked at me, like she recognized who I was already at a very young age. There was something just different. So anyway, what happened to me in my drinking, one of the consequences was, you know, I was a real good student until I started drinking, and then of course my grades started failing, and my dreams of being a famous actress and winning an Oscar, a lot of us are that way, kind of went out the window, but I still had those crazy dreams. But what did happen to me is that I ended up pregnant at a very young age, and I really didn't remember the event. Now, I understand the biology behind it. And since then, I've come to know that it's something you want to remember. You want to fully eventually participate. But apparently that was like a blackout, or, you know. Later, I ended up having brownouts. That's where you don't quite remember, but, you know, somebody mentions a certain thing, it starts coming back to you in an ugly fog. So I ended up pregnant, and back then in the old days, that's not what women did. Girls, you didn't have a baby by yourself. So I ended up giving up my firstborn child for adoption. And I remember feeling the shame, and, you know, I felt like I dishonored my family, and I was so scared. I was so afraid. And I thought, oh, you know, people are gonna find out, blah, blah, blah. But I just wanted to get back to my life. And I will tell you, a month after she was born, and I, you know, signed the papers over, I was already drinking again. And again, I didn't drink every day, but every single day, I thought about it. That obsession to drink was in my head from the first time I drank. Always. How can it be right for me to drink? So, and because I didn't do anything about my drinking, what happened was, a year and a half later, I was in the same situation. I was in an unwed mother's home, all alone, terrified, not knowing what was wrong with me, and I gave up my second born child for adoption. And I remember when they were taking her from the hospital, and I was standing by the window of this room where these other ladies were there feeding their babies, and I was trying to get as far away from them as I could, and I looked out the window and I saw that lady that I had just signed papers with, carrying out this small child, and I knew it was mine. And I wanted to just yell, no, stop. But that part of my brain, this alcoholic, said, You're not worthy. You can't take care of a child. Besides, you need a drink. My alcoholism always talks to me, need a drink. Always trying to find that way. So, you know, and they told me, you'll meet someone, and, you know, you'll have other children, and that's true. I did, and I just want you to know that I did meet someone, and we got married, and we had this little boy, it didn't go well, because he didn't have much of a sense of humor, and if you know me even a tiny bit, you could see where that would be a problem. And he especially didn't think my drinking was very funny. And as it turns out, his lack of humor rubbed off on me because I didn't think his girlfriends were very damn funny either. So, we got a divorce. Big surprise. But I remember we had this last big fight and we were like screaming at each other. You may know this. If you're an alcoholic and you've been in a relationship when you're still in the alcohol stage, where you're screaming at each other at the top of your lungs. You really don't, it probably started over something real tiny, and you don't know why you're still there, but you are, and you're yelling. And we're yelling at each other, and he goes, well, what do you want? Do you want a divorce? And I said, no, I want a gun. I still, to this day, remember his face going completely pale, which was hard because he was very, Azor Portugi, which is very dark, and just kind of, so, but the thing is, I didn't know if I just wanted to shoot him, or being blonde, shoot him and then shoot myself. But I just remember being so angry and so scared. So, you know, we got divorced and I went about my business about life. And I don't know how, but somehow I managed to get through college and I had some great jobs, but I was still drinking. And I was starting to get more disconnected from my family, and I thought it's because they were ashamed of me. I thought it's because they thought, you know, my drinking was not that wonderful. I mean, you can tell, even though, no matter how, by the way, vodka does smell. Gin, all of it smells. We can smell it. You know, whatever it was, but what I found out later is that it was because it was too painful. And if you are somebody who has somebody else in suffering from this disease and wants them to struggle, you will know that pain. And it was too painful for them to see what I was going through. So I ended up working at this real estate company bank, I was in charge of helping disperse money for these big, major construction loans. I was in charge of all these millions of dollars. I didn't take any of it. Thought about it. I don't know how I got that job, but it was a really great job, and it paid well, but it wasn't enough. So I had to get a second job because my drinking and the other things that went along with it, that you might be familiar with, it wasn't enough. So I got a second job. So now's your time to guess what it was. Anybody guess what was missing? Bartender, that's right. Bingo. We make the best bartenders. We know how to pour. So, you know, somebody comes in, oh, would you like that on the rocks? Uh-huh, so how's the wife and kids? Uh-huh, yeah, that's how we pour. So, and by the way, just one time when I spoke and I asked that question, somebody said, stripper. I was like, all proud. Yeah. They would have paid me to take it all off. I can dance. My sponsor at the time was appalled and wanted to smack this guy. Anyway, it did not go well. I'm going to cut it short. I ended up, my relationships, you know, it talks about us, we're tornadoes. Yeah, tornado, hurricane, earthquake, all mixed into one. You know, so my idea was a relationship. If I got involved with somebody who lived further away, then they wouldn't be up in my business all the time. If I could have got a doctor like that, it'd been great. You know the doctors, they always go, how much are you drinking? And they do that thing where they put their hand on your, above your liver and tap it, and you're trying to go, no liver! That didn't, the further away, it didn't make a difference. They eventually found out I couldn't maintain a relationship, and the last major relationship during my drinking was with a guy from Australia. One day I got a letter, like the Dear John except said, Dear Noreen. He said he couldn't be involved with somebody who was living my lifestyle of the drinking and other things, and that maybe I should seek some help. And I remember being just so devastated because, you know, I don't know if I was truly in love with this person, but I was in love with having somebody love me. And so, of course, I went on a binge, and I was like, oh, man, I need to make some changes. So I wasn't feeling, a couple months later, I wasn't feeling all that good. I went to the doctor, hated going to the doctor, hated it. Started asking me these questions. So, when was your last menstrual cycle? Aw, oh, come on! I'm 37 years, 36 years old, 35, I don't know. Really? So, I was pregnant. Yep. So, I was like, all right, I know what's going on now. God is giving me a baby. So I will be responsible and start taking, you know, take control of my life. He's giving me this baby to give me, you know, influence and you know, it's like, yeah, here's you a baby. Now you'll be okay. I just want you to know that some of us really should not have small humans in our custody. However, I thought that, so I thought, that's it. I'm making my changes. So I quit the bartending job. I stuck with just the banking job, and I got rid of some of my, as I call them, my rock and roll clothes and my rock and roll haircut, and I got more conservative, because I'm thinking, if I can fix the outside, make myself look like the rest of the normal people, then I'll be okay. And, you know, I only drank twice after the time that my daughter, before my daughter was born, or after she was born. I didn't drink while I was pregnant, and fortunately, before I found out I hadn't been drinking, I was in a controlled drinking phase. You might have heard of those. Don't recommend them. After she was born, man, I wanted to drink so bad, and I wanted a cigarette so bad, and I wanted to say bad words because I'd gone through this other thing like, oh, don't swear, you know, you have to be good. You know, I was going to church and doing things like, I decided one of the things that would help me turn my life around would be get involved in politics. It seemed like a good idea at the time. So I'm trying to do all these things, but after she was born, man, I wanted to drink and I wanted it bad. And I was obsessing. And have you ever seen somebody riding a roller coaster and they're hanging onto that rail in front like, you know, that's what I felt like. I was hanging on for dear life, trying not to drink. I drank twice from the time she was born, Labor Day of 1987, until my last drink, which was Christmas Day of 1988. I got here in August of 89. You might imagine I should have come in with a couple fire extinguishers. I was dry. I was sick. Anyway, I had that last drink, and that's when I had this major eye-opening experience where I knew from a shadow of a doubt that I was an alcoholic, but that I didn't know what to do. Imagine growing up around Alcoholics Anonymous, having these pamphlets and books stuck in your suitcase when you go to visit your family. You go home, it's like, oh. I remember one time there was a bunch of pamphlets, and I thought, oh, my dad must want me to give these to some of my customers at the bar. So, Anyway, what happened is between that last drink and the time I got here, I obsessed about it every day, and I wanted to stop drinking. I wanted to drink, but I couldn't figure out what to do, and I became suicidal. And I had a plan. And my plan was, I was working in Stockton, the living Modesto, so I was commuting. My plan was to take my car and run into this overpass, because then it would look like an accident. There would be no shame or and insurance, and my daughter would be fine. She'd be better off without me. The world would be better off without me, you know, and I had this plan, and that's what I was going to do. So the day that I was going to do, the first day that I was going to do that, I'm driving along, and I'm like, take off your seatbelt, because you want to make sure you don't do it partial. And I took off my seatbelt, and I started, you know, I'm like, okay, I can do this, and I start speeding up the car, and I started thinking about my daughter. And I started, you know, crying. And I remember being so afraid, and so, I didn't want to die, but I didn't want to live. I didn't know what to do. And for some reason or another, you know, it was like, I said this prayer, God, please help me. And next thing you know, I'm putting that seatbelt on, and I'm driving down the road, and I'm like, I'm going to ask for help. I will tell you 2 miles later, that alcoholic part of my brain started talking. Tomorrow. You can do this tomorrow. You can't possibly. Nobody will understand. Nobody's going to forgive you. You won't be able to fix all this mess you made. You're a horrible mother. And then I think, well, yeah. And then I start thinking they'd have this big funeral and all my friends would come. Oh, I had none. And they'd erect a statue to me and name a theater after me. You thought that too, right? You're like, yeah, they're going to do that. They're going to do that. You know, just this crazy alcoholic thinking, and I'd get home and just pretend everything was okay. And I want you to know this happened for 14 days in a row. I was going to end my life. And every time in between that time, I'd either be at home taking care of my daughter or at work doing my job and pretending like everything was okay. And nobody knew. Well, there was a couple people who kind of gave me the side eye a lot of times. But on the 14th day, something different happened. On the 14th day, there was more sincerity that God, please help me. And on that 14th day, I was able to go and ask for help. And I got in touch with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who also happened to be my father, and said, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm scared, and I don't know what to do. And it was like... And he looked at my mother and he made a horrible judgment, error in judgment, and he said, I told you. You don't say that to an animal. She just gave him, she had this look that she could give. And he's like, sorry. I'm like, I don't know what to do. And he goes, well, you've got to go to meetings. You've got to get a sponsor. You've got to work these steps. You've got to get in service. You know, this is, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action. And I noticed tonight that a lot of you under 60 days were here early and in service. Heck yeah. That's the way you do it. Stay in the center of the herd. Besides, the good snacks are always here early. I was like, well, my dad's like, well, did you go to a meeting? Well, I don't know where to go. Where should I go? And he goes, I know this was hard for him. He goes, I cannot tell you how to do this. You need to get one of the ladies in the program. You need to go to a meeting and find a sponsor. Which meeting should I go to? I cannot choose that for you. And I know how hard, because, you know, he's a lot like me. He likes to kind of boss people around. I called the hotline, the AA hotline, like it was the home shopping club, and, you know, because I'm going to order a sponsor and some meetings and stuff, and some steps. And fortunately, this lady that answered the phone that day was very, very kind. She was like, well, let's get you to a meeting first, and then once you get there, go to some meetings, you'll find somebody that you really relate to. Or maybe you'll find somebody that really pisses you off, and that'd be a good person for you to have as a sponsor. By the way, just a quick note, that was my first sponsor. She was mean. Anyway, so I said, you know, she goes, well, there's this meeting, blah, blah. I said, well, do they smoke there? And she goes, oh, we have some non-smoking meetings. I said, well, I'll take one of those. So I ended up going to a place in Modesto called 12 by 12 Fellowship on Burney Street when it was in this little, we always are in these weird little buildings, you know. It was in this funny little shaped building, and it was a long, you know, not very wide. It was one bathroom. So I went early, and I showed up in clothes I wore to work that day. And for some reason, that day I was wearing, it was really a cool dress, suit, jacket thing. It was blue and black, and I had on black, these pumps that were black and blue, very nice. And for some reason, I thought a black fedora with a blue band would be good. So I had that on. That's how I showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I walked in and turned myself into the person who appeared to be in charge. And she was just looking. I go, hi, this is my first meeting. She's just looking up at me, not saying anything. And I'm like, oh, crap, maybe I shouldn't wear the hat. I called the hotline, and they told me to come here. And she's like, oh, good. And so I'm like, well, I should have asked my dad what the password is, because I don't think they're going to let me in. And so I thought, that's it. And I said, well, my dad's Bud A, and he has 3 years of sobriety. And she goes, excellent. Have a seat. We're going to have a newcomer meeting. And that day they did a newcomer meeting. And I was the only newcomer, so it was all about me. I did not mind that. Some of you might relate to that. And I will tell you that every person that shared, that said something about what it was like for them, what happened, or how they got there, or what it's like for them now, I was like, they're reading my mail. They're in my head. And then I was like, my dad must have called these people and told them what to say. So I would stick around, but I was like, shh. So I started telling the alcoholic part of my brain to just please be quiet, let me do this. That was, you know, there was a guy there, his name was Al B. You know, every group has one who smokes like a million cigarettes, and my name's Al B, I'm an alcoholic, and you don't have to drink today if you don't want to. And there was the little lady who knitted, I'm so glad that you've come to Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been saving a seat for you. You know, but, and then there was young people and old people, every social, economic, you know, different race. It was just like, wow. And I felt like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. I just didn't have the ruby slippers. I was like, there is no place like home. I finally found where I belong. Holy crap. Who knew it would be in Alcoholics Anonymous? But I did. I finally found where I belonged, and that's where I started. That's where my journey began. And it was the first time in my life when people suggested for me to do things or said, hey, can you do this? I go, okay. Or, hey, you got a big book. We're going to meet at such and such time, and we're going to read these pages and bring a towel. You got to write some stuff down. Make sure you have a book. The sponsor I had said, have a book that you don't write in and one that you do write in. Because there may come a time when you need some inspiration, you open the one that you haven't written in and open to a page, and you may find something that you need to read that you didn't know. If it's already highlighted, your eye's going to go there. So, and by the way, those of you who are new, there's a secret that they probably haven't told you here, and I like to spill the beans. There's a secret in this book. It's on page 112 about this program that will help you. This is the third edition. This is the book that I took my first steps in, my first run through the steps in. And the third edition was then. It was around then. Read this book. That's the secret. And they said, okay, we're going to go to this place where... this recovery place, and we're going to do some H and I. And because I'd never had any arrest or any of that other stuff, I got to go to all the places that I should have gone that I didn't go to that many of you may have visited. because I had no record. I got to go to the prisons and the jails. I got to go to the place where they wear paper slippers. That's the only place that scared me, because I thought, you know, any of these women here could bonk me on the head, switch clothes with me, and go out in my place, and I'd be in here in those paper slippers and those special pajamas, and no one would believe me that I didn't belong there. They'd be like, oh yeah, right, that's right, sure you do. Sure you can. So, and that's how my journey started. And I did what was suggested. And I was really fortunate because I had these women around who, because my dad was an old timer, that, oh, we got to help Bud's daughter. And I thought it was because he was like the king of AA or something. What I found out later was they went, oh, we know your dad. He really is crazy. You must be just as nuts. We're going to keep an eye on you, girl. So I remember my first official job in Alcoholics Anonymous was washing the ashtrays. That was in the day we had actually smoked in the meetings. And they would always have like a non-smoking table. One table among six under the vent that sucked all the smoke out. But my job was washing ashtrays. And you know, I was like, but I don't smoke. And they go, that's okay, you can still wash them. So I made myself a little kit with Q-tips and special cleaning wipes. And because I was afraid I'd lose my job and get fired from AA. So, and I put them in a little fanny pack and I show up at the meeting. Here I am. And I took it seriously. I would put the ashtrays away in like glass ones, plastic ones, shapes and sizes. And if one broke, I would go buy another one with my own money. Because I took it seriously. And I was about 6 months sober, and this young person showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous at the meeting I was at. And after the meeting, she wanted to know, she was new, she wanted to know what she could do to help. And the chairperson said, you can wash the ashtrays. So I went over, that's my job. And she goes, oh, we forgot to tell you, you've been promoted. I'm thinking, what glamorous function have they recognized that my talents that I'm going to get to do? And they said, you're going to be cleaning the bathroom. Well, I couldn't say I didn't use that. So that was my job for a while. And I also got to do H&I. And since then, my current job in Alcoholics Anonymous, my service position is I'm the GSR for my home group, again, recording secretary. I'm the Central Valley Intergroup chairperson. And I'm the chairperson coordinator for our Zoom meetings at Northside. Northside has in-person meetings and Zoom meetings. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And we have meetings every day at 7, 9, noon, 6 p.m. sometimes. Yeah, and so we have a lot of meetings. Modesto, if you lived in Modesto, you'd be in a meeting too. So the other thing that happened is that, you know, when I got sober, I had to go on that journey to find out what happened to the children I gave up for adoption. Closed adoption, and it was difficult, but I will tell you, I found them. Found my second born daughter first, Kristen. And there was a place inside me I didn't know was empty that filled up. And she was beautiful. She was tall and blonde and slim. She didn't get that from me. Tan, she didn't get that from me either. And really outgoing and gregarious. Yeah, maybe she got some of that from me. With her help and the parents that adopted her that she grew up with, we went on the journey to find her older sister, and we did. And I want to tell you that both these girls that I had no part in raising, that grew up in these amazing, if you could pick parents for yourself, these people were amazing. Both of these girls, both of my daughters had problems with drugs and alcohol, both of them. And but because, you know, I found them, we reconnected, they found their way into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would love to tell you they're both still here. One of the things that happens to a lot of us is we get sober and we move and we don't connect with our people. We're your people. If you move, you're going to find the same sort of group somewhere else. Find them. Seek them out. We need each other. And she moved, my daughter Andrea and her husband, who she met in, you know, Boy Meets Girl and Alcoholics Anonymous, had a baby. And they moved, and where they moved, they didn't connect with Alcoholics Anonymous or the other programs they belonged to. And of course, it did not end well. My daughter has some serious health issues. She has a rare condition that's kind of like MS, and her youngest son has it as well. So that kind of precludes her from partying and drinking. That slowed that down, so that's kind of good, but she doesn't have this program. You know, you find the friends here. And my daughter Kristen managed to get 5 years. She got married. She was living in Lemoore with her husband, who was in the Navy. She'd gotten 5 years sober, but she quit going to meetings. And she drank again. And she got about 29 days, and she drank again. And she was in Lemoore, and she was going to drive to Thousand Oaks, because she was a drinking driver. Some people would drink, and I got to go on a road trip. I was a drinking dialer. I'd call you up at 2 a.m. to tell you something vitally important about the way you dress or who you're hanging out with. By the way, one time I called the White House at 3 in the morning, insisted I speak to the President of the United States. I had some very important matters to discuss with him. I guess I was a little hostile about it. A couple days later, some gentleman in suits showed up at my job. Yep. Nothing like, I don't know how many people here have ever had Secret Service come talk to you. Is it just me? I'm the one, I took your turn. Oh, you too. Thank you. Compadres. So Kristen was drunk and got in her car and was driving to Thousand Oaks. She got pulled over on the top of the grapevine. And you could tell she was drinking, even though when talking, she didn't sound that bad. She blew a .36. Yeah. And the CHP is like, something must be wrong with this. She should be dead. And he did it again, the same thing. So she got taken to jail. And I don't know why, but that night, they let her out of jail into the custody of her father, the man who raised her, adopted her and raised her. And he took her to the home she was raised in where they lived. He and his wife lived in Thousand Oaks. And that night, on February 10th of 2003, my daughter Kristen, at 31 years old, hung herself. And I know where she was because that's where I was when I got here. I couldn't figure out how to live with it or live without it. And I just wanted it to end. There's this emotional, mental, spiritual pain that you can no longer live with. And I remember when I got the phone call thinking, how can I hurt this bad and still be alive? And yet there was a part of me knew exactly why she did it. You know, and I will tell you, when life knocks you down on your knees, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, they're coming right down there with you. And it's convenient you're on your knees, you might as well say a prayer to a God that you probably don't understand. I hope you don't understand. Because if you understand Him, it's not big enough. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, we were able to walk through all of that. The death of this daughter. And because of that, I got to be there to see the birth of a grandson. And because of that, I got to see my son that I raised and my youngest daughter that I raised, they're freakishly normal. I don't know what happened. See, that's what God does. He goes, oh, you are crazy. We're going to give you one that's going to raise themselves all by themselves. They'll be okay. They're really cool. And I got to see my son graduate from boot camp in the Navy. He's a Navy. And from A school and get married and have children. And he's retiring from the Navy now as a master chief. He's a cool guy. And then I got to see my youngest daughter graduate from high school and college and be very successful. She has an amazing job. She's a really funny, she's a very nice person, normal. When she was little, if I hadn't gone to a meeting in a few days, when she was about, you know, 10 and 12 years, she was in that stage where they start knowing everything, she'd be like, "Mom, when did you go to a meeting last?" All right. So because of that, I got to be there. And because of that, I got to do a lot of the other things I always dreamed of doing. I got to do some acting, paid acting. I know they gave me money for that. I was like, yeah. You know, I got to teach dance. You know, I've done that for about 20 years and a lot of other things. But the most significant thing that I got to do is my mother, when she got sick, I got to help my dad take care of her. Because the doctor said about to me that you need to either come help your dad take care of your mother or get somebody to help, because this will take years off his life. So, you know, I moved back to Modesto and helped my dad take care of my mom. She had MS, congestive heart failure, and AFib. So she got pretty sick in the end. The doctor said she's got, you know, 6 months to a year. She lived 4. Stubborn German. But the last 2 years she was bedbound, and my dad and I had the privilege of taking care of her. And everything that we did for her, because she said she was an amazing person, thank you. Her and my dad were together 70 years. And he would go in the room where she had a hospital bed, had a TV and all this stuff in there, and he'd go and take his chair in there and put it next to her bed, lower her bed, and put down the rail so they could hold hands and watch TV. And they would say things to each other like, "You're the best thing that's ever happened to me. I love you. I can't believe I'm so lucky to have you." It was pretty amazing to see. I have high standards for relationships because of that. That's what I saw. That's what I found it recently, about 13 years ago. Anyway, you know, we got to be there. We got to be there when she passed. She got to pass at home. And after she went, we were kind of lost for a while. Oh, Mom, what do we do now? And so I did the thing that I've always done. Like when my daughter Kristen died, I took another service position. I found another newcomer to work, to torment, work with. You know, take them through this thing called the book. This is the book that I took my steps in the first time. It's the third edition. And there were still, when I got sober, there were still people, "Why are you doing that third edition? That's no good. You get the second edition. That's better." It's like, well, now we get the fourth and we're working on the fifth. Some of us do not like change, but here's the thing, one of the things my grandpa always said, you know, change is good. Imagine how stinky the world would be if we didn't change our underwear on a daily basis. Makes sense. Change is good. So my dad was doing really well. He's very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, always was, and in service. And, you know, towards the end, he got a lot more mellow. He used to say, "I got to be nice. I can't outrun nobody, and I can't whip nobody." So, he had a lot of really funny sayings. And so he got sick about a year and a half ago, started having heart trouble, and he ended up having 4 stents put in, and we thought we were past that. I can't tell you how many ER visits I made. You know, you've been to a lot when you walk in, they go, "Oh, hi, Maureen." They know you by name. I brought my dad down. But he was doing pretty good, but he ended up with stage 4 cancer, and it happened fast. And the way that they explained it to me, "Your dad's 95 years old. You know, things will move faster, surprisingly, in an old person." And he's gone through a lot this past year, so his immune system is down. So October, the end of October, they said he had less than 6 months. And so we got the hospice in, and I, you know, got to be there at, to take care of my daddy, take care of my dad. And I promised my mother I would watch out for him. And at the end of November, he started really fading super fast. We got the hospital bed in there. He slept most of the day, and he was kind of restless, and he was practically comatose. But he did get some last rites, and it was an amazing experience because after the priest left, this kind of peace came over him. And he always talked about when he first got sober and he asked God to help him. And he said his prayer was, God, either give me something else, either take my life or give me something better. And he said he felt this peace that passes all understanding. And that's what I saw happen. He just, it just, this peaceful look and that early that morning he passed. And I got to be there. And my niece was there, who's also in the program. When you're 63 years over, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and active, you kind of know a few people. And guess what? My time's up. I have technical challenges. So I got to be there, and I got to make all those phone calls that you make and do all the stuff. And then, I got to find out that I need to seek outside help because these last couple years have been very emotionally trying and stressful. And so I go to a grief group. Best part was when the doctor was saying, now, you might feel uncomfortable talking in front of a group of people about personal issues. And I'm like, I'm an alcoholic, I go to AA meetings, I think you'll be okay. So I do that, and I'm seeing a counselor, and we're doing all the stuff we gotta do, and we had a really nice memorial service for him, and I was able to deliver an appropriate eulogy, and there was a lot of people there. It was a packed place. It was amazing, and I feel disconnected. I feel adrift. I feel unmoored, just like when my mother passed. And yet, I've just done what I was told, and I reach out to other members of Alcoholics Anonymous, like Wendy, who, bless her heart, not only said she'd come with me, she drove. She drove her car, which is awesome. When I'm asked to be of service, I suit up and I show up. I want you to know that no matter what happens in your life, a drink is not going to change it. And I want you to know that there's going to come a time that something horrible will happen and you don't think the solution isn't a drink. That's a miracle. That is a miracle I've experienced when my daughter passed and I didn't think about drinking. When my mother passed and I didn't think about drinking. When good things happen, sometimes we think we got a hot handle on this now. A drink will be good. I can have a beer now. But no. And it's changed. And that's been the miracle for me. So, again, welcome to the newcomers. Welcome. Glad you're still here, all those old-timers and mid-timers. If you're ever in Modesto, please look me up. There's some really interesting people there that you'll probably want to meet. Yeah, so again, thank you for the committee for putting us up in the hotel and for the wonderful dinner. The food was excellent, and for your warm welcome and for the invitation to be there. And I want to read, oh, I forgot, I always read this at the very end. I'm putting on my reading glasses here. This is on page 164. I'm not going to apologize if I cry. I just do it. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and to countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall surely be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.